informative and engaging. Rick Munn. Rick Munn on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Yes, our number two of Locked and Loaded today. Just looking at that lovely Belfast sign over behind my, what year is this? Everything's reversed here. It's my, I don't know. It's over my head. That's all you need to know. And someone made a nasty comment. The best thing about Belfast is the exit sign taking you out of it. Can't disagree. Can't disagree. It ain't the place that it was back in the day. And that's even during the bombings and the shootings. Somehow, it's deteriorated even further since then. And strangely, one of my very first ever Twitter contacts or ex-contacts is coming over to Northern Ireland on Saturday. And I'm actually going to pick him up at the airport. So I'm going to be going to Belfast for the first time in about a year and a half, maybe 2 years. Told him I'd pick him up and take him into town. He's going to meet somebody else there and then head off into the country. But I thought it would be good to catch up with him. So yes, I will be in there on Saturday for a couple hours anyway. And then I'm getting the hell out as fast as I can once that business is done. So what's coming up in this hour? You might be wondering, maybe you're not wondering it, maybe you don't give a damn, but I'm going to tell you whether you like it or not. We've got Gemma Cooper coming on in just a minute, and she's actually going to be staying with me until 5:30 today, so that's great. Getting an extra 10 minutes talking to her, which I enjoy very, very much. And then Hedley Rees will be coming on here for the first time, certainly, on Locked and Loaded. Who's this guy, you might be wondering? Well, Hedley has over 40 years experience, or had over 40 years experience, in the pharmaceutical industry. Ooh, sounds like a nasty piece of work then, doesn't he? But no, he wrote a great book called Taming the Big Pharma Monster, standing out in a sea of books trying to skewer Big Pharma. So he reminds me a little bit. I had a great guest on here that I spoke to quite frequently from Australia, Dr. Philip Altman. This is, I suppose, the UK equivalent of Dr. Altman. Is a Hedley Rees. I'm really looking forward to talking to him at 5:30 to take us up to the top of the hour. I mentioned earlier on at the start of the show about the two gigs that are coming up in the Lake District. As again, check out the website, tntradio.live, look at the What's On section, and you'll see what those events are. Briefly, the Assange business, I talked about it with Phil Zimmerman very briefly. Didn't go into the ins and outs of the actual story itself, though, just for people's information, the US have provided assurances to prevent Julian Assange's appeal against extradition. So the death penalty will not be imposed, they said, but WikiLeaks founder's wife, Stella Assange, said he will not be afforded First Amendment protections. So last month, two judges deferred a decision on whether Assange, who is trying to avoid being prosecuted in the US on espionage charges, clearly relating to the publication of thousands of classified documents that they say endanger life, and so on and so forth. So bottom line is here, the US government have said, pinky promise, we won't put him to death when he gets there. Yeah, that's a little bit like if a crocodile could talk or a great white could talk and you're on a surfboard and you're thinking of going into the ocean for a little dip and he said, don't worry, I won't bite. Honestly, I'm not hungry in the slightest. Yeah, you pay your money and you take your chances. If you trust anything at all that comes out of any politician's mouth, let alone an American politician's mouth, then fool are you. Fool are you. But anyway, I don't think they're buying that one somehow, but that's what the state of play is with that one as per right now. So we're going to take a brief pause. Our news correspondent, Gemma Cooper, is on her way onto your screen in the blink of an eye here. So don't go away or you'll miss it on TNT, today's news talk.
Conversations to inform and include.
It's meant for everyday people to understand.
Today's news talk radio, TNT.
So many people are in such a mess in this world, Gemma, because they take people at face value and they believe promises that are made from either known psychos or people that they don't really know at all. They just take them at face value. How many people are in a mess because of that? Oh, yeah, I like the look of that guy. She looked like a nice person. They promised me they wouldn't do that. They said they wouldn't do that, and then they did it. How many people take people at face value and end up coming a cropper as a result of it?
Well, I've done it myself many times in my life. I mean, quite a few people have said to me in my life, you're a bit too trusting, Gem. You're a bit too naive. And someone said to me once, how could a woman as so switched on as you be so bloody gullible? Because if someone tells me something, It's happened here on TNT. I think it's happened with you, actually, Rick. You know, someone tells me something, I'll believe them. I just trust until somebody gives me reason not to. Now, I think that's quite a good way of approaching the world personally, but I'm terrible with it. Someone can say anything to me. I go, oh, really? Oh, my God, that's terrible. They're like, Coops, winding you up. I'm a sucker for it myself. I think you've got me a couple of times, actually.
I've got you lots of times. I've restrained myself from multiple trolls of you. Listen, don't take it personally. Everybody I know gets trolled mercilessly by me. I take this perverse kick out of conning people and manipulating people and leading them up the garden path and winding them up. It just entertains me on a psychopathic personal level. So don't take that one personally at all. But here's the thing. And I mean, we've all been guilty of it. You do tend to give people the benefit of the doubt. And my old granda, God rest his soul, he was the most cynical, miserable old get around. But he used to say his catchphrase was, trust no one, trust no one. And that's the way he used to say it. I thought, he's a miserable old sod, isn't he? But you know what? He kind of had a point. Trust is something that I believe should be earned, Gemma. And certainly, if you look at the track record of the person that's promising you the earth or making you promises, oh, don't worry, this will never happen again. It was just a blip. Please forgive me. It won't happen again. Too many people are too trusting. And I think that's, and I'm guilty of it too. I've put my trust in people and been absolutely royally screwed over by them. But you live and learn. You have to live and learn.
Well, it does rather remind me of one of the headlines I'll be bringing. It wasn't going to be my top headline because we kind of touched on it at the top of the last hour. But of course, it's dodgy David Cameron, our unelected foreign secretary. I mean, you know, just very recently, it could have been a few days ago, but certainly within the last week, it all blurs into one sometimes, the news. But he was asked, you know, are there any circumstances, Mr. Cameron, where you would consider becoming prime minister of the UK again? And he said, absolutely not, unequivocally not. And I thought, as soon as I heard him say he wasn't going to be prime minister again, I thought, that means he's going to be prime minister again. There's no two ways about it, because he is one person that he says one thing and the opposite happens. And of course, as we said earlier, he's now in Israel, telling Benjamin Netanyahu how to not start World War III, except the fact he's a rampant warmonger. And he just got off the plane a few hours ago. So we will make this the top headline. I mean, he said a lot. Reporters were there to meet him. He gave an impromptu press conference and said that Israel needs to act in a way that is smart as well as tough. He said lots and lots of things, and he's one of several foreign ministers, world leaders, effectively, going over to Israel for the next few days to advise on foreign policy. But he's one I don't trust. Even I'm not that stupid, but I did know, as soon as he said, I don't want to be prime minister, you can just invert that one straight away. And I'm going to start placing a few bets. And I'm not a betting woman, but I might go to my local bookie and say, look, I'm going to put a few bets on this, and then and have a nice maybe holiday on the proceeds when he eventually is, once again, almost unelected leader of the UK. So that's one of the headlines today. Calls to ban smacking of children in Northern Ireland and England. Paediatricians, we're absolutely united on this. It's already banned in Scotland and Wales. They say smacking children actually has such terrible implications for your adult life. They want it absolutely banned as soon as possible in Northern Ireland and England. Prime Minister's Question Time, the weekly PMQs, has just got underway in the House of Commons. Expected to be dominated by Israel and Iran and what's going to happen there. And also, you know, the Rwanda bill, that's going to also be under scrutiny. They want it to be law by tomorrow. Let's see. And also a really disturbing headline about the state of England's health. Nearly 4 million workers in England will have major conditions and illness by the year 2040, according to experts. People in the poorest areas are much more likely to die before the age of 70. That's not even the UK lifespan. And of course, this comes after unemployment figures out yesterday show unemployment is rising, compounded by the fact that the number of workers released today by figures by the Office for National Statistics, number of workers often long-term sick, already is nearly 3 million. Compound that with people who are expected to have life-threatening illnesses within the next 16 years. It's not a pretty picture for the health or state of the nation here in the UK.
No, it's not. And I saw some footage of people that were putting together, you know, health gurus putting together clips of, say, America and England back in the 1950s, the 1960s, the 1970s, the 1980s, right up until the 1990s. Generally speaking, people were reasonably fit and healthy. At least they looked reasonably fit and healthy. There was no obesity. epidemic back then. Pictures of beaches, you know, beaches in America, everyone running around in their Speedos or their bikinis, no fatties there, no love handles on display. Greenpeace weren't trawling up and down, rolling people back into the water, mistaking them from beached humpback whales. That didn't happen back in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, but it seems to be happening now, Gemma, and a lot of the blame for that is being put on the massive excess sugar consumption that we have now and processed foods. That's another one. Back then, you know, cooking in lard, using real butter, drinking whole fat milk, eating your meat and the vegetables and a little bit of fruit. There was no 200 gram bags of crisps back then and 400 gram dairy milk bars that people were scoffing into them on a nightly basis while they were loafing on the sofa watching Emmerdale and Coronation Street. People were actually out playing in the streets back then and being physically active. That seems to be a thing of the past in general, does it not?
Absolutely. And I think there's the physically active one, actually, that is more important, not more important than diet. They do have equal billing. But, you know, if you remember, obviously, you and I are a very similar age. And like the amount of cars on the roads in the 1970s and 80s is nothing compared to now. Everybody in the family seems to have a car, which means you're not walking anywhere. And I remember my mum, she didn't drive until quite late in life, as did I. I didn't drive until late in life, you know, going to the supermarket and trudging home with massive heavy bags of shopping, which she'd quite often get me and my brother to help with. But of course, keeps you fit. Those things keep you fit. And I do remember similar images that I really took me aback when I was at my old job and we had to dig out some old footage of people on the beach at Weston Supermare, which is a very famous beach here in the southwest of England, from the 1980s, actually. And it was to commemorate some anniversary. And then we dug the footage out and a load of us at work were like, wow, everybody looks like supermodels. You know, the women looked fantastic. There was not an ounce of fat on the men. And this was only the 80s, the early 80s. And look how much has changed since then of like the way we look is not, you know, you go onto the average British beach, it's not particularly an attractive proposition. And I include myself in that. You know, I wouldn't, you know, subject the world to me in a bikini anymore. Not by a long way, not by a long, long way. But people did look, well, there we go.
I don't look as good in my bikini now as I did when I was in my late teens. I'll tell you that for a fact, Gemma. I would probably be arrested for gross indecency if I went out in a pair of tight Speedos right now. I tell you, they would lock me up for frightening people rather than displaying my Adonis-like body. Yeah, I'm in no position to judge, by the way, but I'm just making the comment. When you do, for example, use that as the barometer, or even schools nowadays. Remember back in school, you know, every school, every class had a fat kid who got mercilessly bullied. There was always one fat kid in every class. Now it's the other way around. You have to almost hunt to find the skinny kid now. There's so much childhood obesity going on. And I do think that's a combination of that, terrible diet, processed foods, junk food available at every corner, and the lack of exercise. We were out on the bikes at night. We were running around knocking people's doors and being chased by angry men for disturbing their evening's peace, playing army, playing hurt. You know, used to jump over everybody's fences and hedges and wreck the rose bushes, charging round the block. Those days, I don't see kids out playing on the street anymore. I don't see kids out on bikes, loads of kids on bikes. You just don't see that anymore, at least not where I live.
I do wonder how much of this is by design, you know, and that the so-called, you know, people who we're supposed to trust, you know, say they're doing everything they can to improve the nation's health. And then you get a report like this that says, well, by 2040, a lot of people are going to be dead. And if you live in a poor area, forget it. You're not going to make life expectancy. And yet all of these products and all the junk food and all the big fast food outlets that, you know, they're allowed to expand with absolute impunity. And, you know, not to get too cynical, but, you know, we have an aging population in this country. There's not enough people being born to pay for the generation above them, which is how state pension has always worked. So if people do start dying as a result of bad food and a sedentary lifestyle, to the powers that be, it's not such a bad thing, is it? So they say all these things about, you know, so it goes back to trusting people again. They say, oh, we're doing everything we can to protect the health of the, you know, clean up your diet and do more exercise. But they don't really, the acts are the facts. They don't ban anything. And if you walk down any supermarket, you will see all of those junk foods that you're talking about, lovely, bright packaging. Nothing is really ever done a sugar tax, well, it's never really enough, is it, to put people right off? I mean, what puts people right off is things like the price that have gone up, like olive oil, for example, the cost of living. Olive oil's gone up from £4 to £5 a bottle, or maybe less, actually, £3 a bottle 18 months ago to £13 a bottle. That is putting people off buying olive oil. If you had a sugar tax that did similar, that would really put people off. You know, there'd be no doubt about that. But they don't really ever go that far, do they? So I wonder if it's in their interest to have a sick nation, sick note nation, which these figures today back up, it equals economic stability going forward because everybody's dead. Sorry to put too fine a point on it, but last 4 years. Yeah,
that's
exactly.
That's what's happening. I went out last night on I'm trying to eat more fruit and vegetables, more healthy food. And if you go into any supermarket, there's never a buy one, get one free deal on for a punnet of British raspberries or blackberries. A punnet of blackberries last night, I looked up, there must have been about half a dozen blackberries in it. £3! £3 doesn't exactly incentivize me to buy those. You know, bananas are pretty good value, but if you're trying to buy some other tasting fruit, it's not cheap. But then you go around the corner, and as you're getting to the super, you're seeing, you know, 500 gram bars of Cadbury's Dairy Milk for sliced down to £1.25. Are these family bags, 20 bags of crisps in a family bag, buy one, get one free. So the muck that's available is always on the cheap, and it's always used to lure people in, obviously, to buy other products. But the healthy stuff and the olive oil is another one that you mentioned. I like to cook with that olive oil if I'm using oil. Yeah, cheap bottle, medium-sized bottle, £7-8. But I feel like I have to pay it because, you know, I'm trying to invest in my health a little bit here. But the sugar taxes that you also mentioned, they're there, but they're negligible. You know, if you buy Diet Coke, which is also full of aspartame and badness, but I'm just saying, if you buy it versus Fatty Coke, the price difference isn't that much more. But you go to the olive oil and all of a sudden it's £13 a bottle. Definitely a de-incentivization to buy that, but it doesn't put you off buying the sugary muck that's on sale hand over fist in these places. We've got to take a brief, ad break here. And when we come back at the other side, let's look at this impact on health on the sick note culture and also on UK unemployment rates, because figures have just came out on them as well. So we'll maybe touch on that when we come back at the other side here on TNT, Today's News Talk.
TNT's Jason Allbourne.
Also out of Iran, comments coming from Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashatani said any nation that helps Israel mount an attack against Iran will face serious consequences. The statement came as Tehran launched that airstrike against Israel in what it called retaliation for an Israeli attack. So we are dealing with some very, very heavy news this weekend. And for those that are watching this show, know that we concentrate on what I would call both sides of the fall of the Roman Empire, all the events leading up to what is coming in what many perceive as an inevitable collapse one way or another, others see a descent into absolute tyranny.
Weekends with Jason Allbourne on Today's News Talk, TNT.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
A hoax about carbon dioxide in the climate has caused a global energy and economic disaster. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Good grief. Okay, we're still in conversation. I'm very happy to announce with Gemma here this morning, where we're talking about health having an impact, obviously, on people's ability to work, whether that be physical health or mental health. Gemma, a figure just coming out yesterday, update on unemployment. So it has jumped as the UK job market has stalled. So the bottom line is here, the unemployment rate increased to 4.2% between December and February of this year, which is the highest level for 6 months. Meanwhile, the rate of people with a job dipped, and the economically inactive, this is a category of people we have referred to more than one occasion, those not in work or not even looking for employment also ticked higher. The Economist suggests the data could spur another interest rate cut, which of course inflation apparently is going to spur that as well. With unemployment falling sharply and the unemployment rate climbing, we suspect wage growth will continue, blah, blah, blah. The bottom line is here, there's less people working and more importantly, less people wanting to work than ever before, I think collectively at this time, which again doesn't bode well for the future, does it?
No, and but it is. We've discussed this story so many times about why people aren't working, and like the scamdemic had a lot to do with that, and furlough, and a lot of people have been fortunate enough to look at their finances, look at their lives, and think I can just about manage, and just about managing is better for a lot of people than work. And the whole kind of arguments about work gives you dignity, work gives you meaning. A lot of people have turned their backs on that. And the over 50s were originally cited as the kind of worst culprits for the economically inactive. They basically got some time off during the scamdemic and thought, I don't want to go back and I can almost take my pension, some people thought, because you can take part of your pension in the UK at 55 now. So they probably thought, I'd just hold out. But then figures came out just a few months ago showing it wasn't the over 50s that were to blame. It was younger people of working age. I think it was 16 to 34, the 19 to 34 year olds were the ones most likely to be economically inactive. And that's kind of what's ostensibly known as Generation Z or millennials, mm-hmm. who have a very different attitude to work now, looking maybe up the food chain and thinking, well, I don't want to spend my life like that. And saying, why would I drag myself into an office where I don't even like anybody? I mean, you'll probably resonate with this, Rick. I've heard you talk about your former life many times. I don't like anybody. I don't like my boss. I don't like the work I'm doing. And this is my one precious life. So it's a very, is it a bad thing? It's bad for the economy, but is the economy the holy grail? Is a simple life without much material possessions and money better for the human soul and psyche? Is it part of this growing awakening that people are having, thinking, I don't want to live my life like I'm being told to live it? You know, get an education, get a job, work really, really hard, and maybe have a few good years at the end. Maybe it's part of something bigger, a shift in our culture. I don't know. But economically, if you're not working, you're not paying your taxes or your stamp, which then goes to funding the generation above you that expects a pension on retirement. So yeah, there is, you know, but looking at the sickness figures, everybody's going to be dead anyway, as we were just talking about before the break. So where this goes, who knows? But it's not going away. This issue's not going away. I see it growing myself personally, this economically inactive and unemployment as a whole.
I think you're right. And the one thing I'll say is this notion of going off grid, dumping all your possessions, cutting free from the matrix, it's super romantic and it's really attractive. It's a fantastic proposition. And I get why so many people are aspiring towards that. And I've sampled a little bit of it when I've done some overseas stuff, no electric, no running water, no shops, no internet, none of that. And believe it or not, it does cleanse your mind and your spirit when you go and you live like that. But I'll tell you this, after 6 weeks, 7 weeks of, you know, that type of life, it does, the romanticism does lose its sheen a little bit. And I think that's why there are people that do go off grid and do live very, very happily and do that for a prolonged period of time. But I think the reason why a lot more people aren't doing it is because maybe they've tried it for a time, or they've tried that relocation and chucking in the corporate jobs, which is a killer on the mind. And it is a debt trap to get stuck into. But also, if you go too far the other direction, you know, you could find yourself scratching your head going, hey, I'm living in a tent here. I don't have 2D to my name and I'm, you know, 60 years of age, whatever. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but I'm saying it can be a real shocker for a lot of people that followed that dream. And then how would you say, the sheen wore off after maybe 6 months or a year or 2 years. And then people are going, fucking hell, how am I ever going to get back out of this hole again? So I think a little bit of balance is very important with all of this, Gemma, too.
It is. And I don't think people are going necessarily off grid. I think we've got a lot of people staying at home, watching TV, playing computer games, you know, staring at a screen, which is all part of you know, Agenda 2030 and WEF goals, which is to keep people isolated in homes. And it does pave the way for universal basic income, where people say, oh, don't worry, if you don't want to work, we'll give you money just enough, but you've got to do what you're told now. And having enough money just enough is often an incentive just enough to do just what you're told. This could be where this is going. Why I'm thinking that is there doesn't seem to be, we're seeing a lot of these headlines about the economically inactive, those who don't want to work, but we're not seeing a huge amount now of government pushback to get them back in to work. And as I said previously, you know, the acts are the facts. We're not seeing the government doing enough to clamp down on junk food, increasing sugar taxes. We're not seeing the government really be concerned enough to push people back into work and say, well, you've got to. It's as simple as that. We keep seeing the headlines about how many people are off and never seeing the headlines about what's being done about it. So is this a push to a much more sinister future? I would wager it is. That's my own personal opinion. Maybe some in the chat will agree. It's a UBI plan in the making because nobody wants to go to work. Don't worry, we'll do it all for you. And another form of control is ushered in by stealth without us really realizing it. That's where I think this is. But I understand the kind of, you know, the ease with which, you don't want to be part of the corporate matrix. I was part of it myself. And I think as well, your exploits were in Africa, you were off grid. And of course, when you're in a hot country, it's much easier to do it. Much easier to do it. You don't have freezing conditions at night where you could die. It's harder to grow food, but it's nicer all round in terms of the kind of level of life you've got day to day. Hard to do in the
UK.
For
your mental health too, Gemma, living in a sunny place, it doesn't matter what's going on in your life. When you wake up in the morning at 6 o'clock and the sun's beaming down, the skies are blue, it's a beautiful temperature, there's a soft breeze blowing, it helps you to deal with life. And I used to say to those Africans, because every other aspect of their life was hellish and a real struggle to exist, I said, if you people didn't have the sun, if you had Irish weather, you would all be hopping yourselves probably, because it would be just too much to deal with. So that's another factor to bear in mind as well. If you're going to go off grid, I advise somewhere sunny that doesn't rain a lot and the temperature usually stays above at least 15 degrees Celsius. Otherwise, mentally, it's going to be an absolute slog. But who knows? Leave us your messages, thoughts, comments, and opinions in the live chat on that one. Gemma, got to call time in this one. I could talk to you all day about this, but we can't because we've got to take a headline break. And then I'm speaking with Hedley Rees straight afterwards. So big thanks to you for staying on, Gemma, and adding your thoughts and opinions there. We'll talk again tomorrow. And I'll be back after this short break here with Hedley on TNT, today's news talk.
I got news for you.
TNT Radio News.
It's about time.
Matt Boylan here with a look at your TNT headlines. Australia's unveiled a new national defence strategy with a greater focus on the Pacific as tensions rise with China. Israel's brutality against Palestinians in Gaza is once again in the spotlight after a new mass grave was uncovered at the Al Shifa Hospital. And the BBC has come under fire after one of its radio hosts flipped the script and took aim at the West for refusing to hold Israel accountable for the mounting civilian death toll.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk.
TNT Radio.
TNT Radio.
Yes, coming at you live here this Wednesday, the 17th of April, 2024. TNT Locked and Loaded. I'm Rick Munn, and I'm joined for the first time on Locked and Loaded by the one and only Hedley Rees. And anyone that's not familiar with Hedley Rees, let me tell you a little bit about him. He had over 40 years' experience in the pharmaceutical industry. Woo! Nasty way to introduce a guest, that if anything. However, that did lead to an expose of the industry in denial, uncompromising on facts and evidence. He wrote a book called Taming the Big Pharma Monster. And according to one review, at least, Hedley had said that book of yours stands out in a sea of books trying to skewer Big Pharma because it also offers practical solutions. So welcome to TNT. How are you doing this fine Wednesday morning?
I'm doing good, Rick. Thanks. And that was a nice piece of research there. I didn't tell you that. So, so it's great to be on here. And I wrote Taming the Big Pharma Monster because, you know, I called this industry out in 2011 when I wrote a book for Wiley, Supply Chain Management in the Drug Industry. I basically said the supply chains are the world's most disconnected supply chains. There's no ownership. Most of the work is done by contractors who work on a fee-for-service basis. And effectively, what Big Pharma do is they patent molecules, and then they do the sales and marketing. The hard yard work in between of product development and supply chain is in the hand of third parties, contractors. And it's no surprise that Big Pharma has not been making money for the last 30 years. It's just managing to keep blockbuster earnings by recycling patents, you know, and basically gaming the whole patent system to create monopolies. And I see this latest SARS-CoV-2 injection as last chance saloon for Big Pharma, because it's the only way they can make $80 billion profit in 1 year.
Yeah, this business, if we could just look at the timelines here, okay, so you said that you first started to expose this back in 2011, so that was, what, 13 years ago? That book that you wrote, Taming the Big Pharma Monster, I believe that was written and published around about 2019. Is that around about right? Is that correct? Yeah,
exactly. Well, for all I said in that first book, which sold in 35 countries, but Wiley's obviously a global publisher, nothing changed. In fact, things got worse. And in 2019, I thought, look, I've got to get the word out here. I'd already written one book that hadn't gone anywhere. So I hosted a conference in Cardiff Bay, called Medicines for the 21st Century, Safe, Better, Cheaper. And about 60 people there, clinicians, charity, general public, supply chain people. And we got a lot out. I wrote a white paper based on that conference. And Taming the Big Pharma Monster was a companion book to the conference. And even then, ironically, this was just before COVID. And even then, that didn't sell an awful lot, even though I was very explicit in explaining everything that's gone on. In a sense, what's happened now over the last 4 years validates what I've been saying. Because, you know, you cannot develop a drug in 12 months without major transgressions of 60 years of regulations that are put in place to keep patients safe. You know, it's the supply chain produces the product that goes into the patient's arm. It's nothing else. It's not science. It's not doctors. And people don't realize that. If Airbus, Boeing, McDonnell Douglas, they decided, look, we're not going to produce the planes anymore. We're just going to sell them. We're going to patent the designs, and we're going to sell them. And all the bit in between, we're going to get other companies to do. Now, think of the complexity of that supply chain, and think how they need the people who are doing that on a fee for service. They need to be managed very carefully to make sure that everything is safe. But they've got no skin in the game. They get paid no matter what. I'm not saying they're bad companies per se, but they've got different objectives, boards of directors. And, you know, we've had this now where no one's known what's happening in the supply chain. I wouldn't like to think what physical vials, aluminium seals, lipid nanoparticles, all these things all over the world, through billions of vaccines being manufactured, a lot of it still physically exists. Where are these things being disposed of? Who is disposing of them? You know, someone needs to take accountability for saying, okay, these have been pushed on the world in huge quantities. We've got to take stock of where we are.
Let's rewind back to 2019. And I suppose since 2019, many people weren't expecting what was going to happen in the world in 2020, when the so-called COVID pandemic was unleashed upon the world and people were in fear. And then, of course, right off of the back of that, we had this lightning fast warp speed, as Donald Trump called it, development of the cure-all vaccines that were brought out. Okay, so since that has happened, Headley, without a shadow of a doubt, I don't believe there's never been a time in history when the spotlights have been on Big Pharma the way that they're on them now, because of the events of the last 3 to 4 years with the rollout of this global rollout of this campaign. A lot of the fallout from that, it was marketed as being safe and effective, which of course it proved to be neither safe nor effective. There's a lot of people being injured and killed as a result of it. And in the past, Used to be that if a trial or a drug was brought to market, you know, two or three deaths or some a handful of adverse reactions would have been enough to pull the product off the market completely. We've seen that trend completely bucked whenever the Oxford AstraZeneca product came in the market. You had your Johnson & Johnson came on the market. You had your Pfizer product, of course, came in the market, the Moderna product. All these products coming to market in lightning time. Did you feel at the time, I mean, like me personally, I can remember in 2020 when I heard about this, I have a little bit of a background in science of a degree and an honors degree in human anatomy and know a little bit about the way the body works and a little bit about the way drugs are brought to market, not to your level. But I was thinking back then going, hang on a minute. Usually it's what, 10, 15, maybe 20 years of clinical trials before a product is signed off as, you know, safe for human consumption, if even. This is being done in 9 months. Nobody's asking any questions. And anybody that did ask questions was being banned or shut down on any platform that they had. What was your take on it back then? Did you find that it was extremely odd given your actual pharma background?
Well, there's two things. There was a huge red flag when these injections were coming into vaccination centers, frozen down to minus 70 degrees centigrade for Pfizer-BioNTech and minus 20 for Moderna. And then people in the vaccination center were left to carry out the production that still hadn't been done, because those vaccines, there were, for Pfizer, there were 5 doses in a vial, as I say, frozen down to 190 degrees C, 195 vials in a cardboard tray. Now, when you thaw any material, you have to carry out studies to determine the conditions under which you thaw, so that you know what you started with as a frozen item, you've got the same molecular structure with the thawed item. Now, none of those studies could have been carried out, and people were just guessing. The instructions were on the internet, if you managed to find them, and they were so complicated, and they explained further manufacturing operations. So once they thawed those vials, they had to insert saline diluent into the vial and then mix it by turning the vial over 10 times. Now, mixing again is a very critical production operation, because if it's not done properly, it becomes, you know, homogeneous. Then you can have hot spots, or you can have spots that don't have any drug in there. So the variation in potency on those vials was guaranteed. So people were going to get very high doses of what was an experimental drug in the first place. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, people were untrained with injecting. And the point of this is, never before have these vaccine ever gone to doctor surgery unless they were delivered by wholesalers. This is in the UK, it's Alliance Health, it's Aloga, it's these guys, these lorries you see on the road, they pull up at the hospital pharmacy or community pharmacy and they take all the drugs in. They can only handle either refrigerated materials or room temperature. So refrigerated plus 2 degrees. They had no possibility to handle minus 70 or minus 20. So, and those are the guys who are trained in how you handle these to keep them safe, to make sure they go into fridges, to make sure that, you know, no one does anything to them, that the transportation and all the logistics is correct. We don't know how these injections got into the vaccination centers. I've got a very good educated guess on who did it. And they're what they call pre-wholesalers, which are companies who work for pharmaceutical companies and store products and ship them. So that's the first thing. That's the red flag. The other thing, of course, is that the regulations dictate that when you apply for a license, you have to do safety studies in animals. You have to produce a small quantity of the drug. This is like 10 kilos or 10 liters, and you have to build a supply chain to do that. So you have to appoint contractors, you have to audit them first, and then once they've made this 10 kilos, which could take 6 or 9, even 12 months, because this is chemical and biological processing, They then have to send the supply chain material into what they know as a contract research organization that specializes in these tests in animals. And they do the tests, they write the reports, they send the study reports back to the company. And depending on those reports, either they say, look, this is a pretty safe drug, or, you know, there's elements of toxicity about this, therefore we can't use it in humans. So it's a US government accountability form of statistic that preclinical testing takes 3 years. That's based on analyzing years worth of data. And you can't get more blue chip than the US Government Accountability Office.
Yeah.
And that same office statistic is that it takes 7 years in clinical trials, because you've got to produce a larger batch. And once you produce a larger batch, you can create a different product. You can get a polymorph or some molecular a change due to the process of scaling up. So you have to redo the studies in animals in that new lot size. And again, you have to prove that that's still safe. So as you're making product for clinical trials, you are scaling up and having to repeat the safety studies. Now, to get to billions of doses, I can't imagine the size of the scale up. It would have been certain to have created changes to the drug that should have been tested, but clearly weren't. So, and then the regulator typically takes 12 to 18 months to assess the supply chain. So the company has to submit all the details on the supply chain, or the contractors, where they are, the inspection record, all those things. And it takes 12 months, 18 months for them to say, okay, that's fine. Or not?
Yeah, the reason why it's great to hear you saying this is because if somebody like me had made this point or this argument over the last 3 years, the first thing that would have been said to me is, but you're not a scientist. You don't work in the pharmaceutical industry. You're just an armchair researcher. You have no credentials. You have no viability to what you're saying. But with somebody like yourself, who has 40 years experience working in the pharmaceutical industry and qualified up to the hilt, when it comes from the horse's mouth, as it were, then we'll have to take attention to what you're actually saying here this morning, Hadley. And you're effectively, verifying a lot of what I felt and believed, you know, questions that I asked right off the get-go in this. But of course, I was dismissed back then as just an Irishman with a tinfoil hat on, that I shouldn't be asking questions. I should just be taking everything at face value. We've got to take a little ad break now, just for a minute or two. And when we come back at the other side, you mentioned about scaling, you know, manufacturing, clinical trials, experimental phases. I'm even looking at EUAs, experimental use authorizations for these drugs as well, how they all came together to put us into the position that we're actually in now. We'll get into that in a little bit more depth when we come back after this break with Hadley Rees here on TNT, Today's News Talk.
I said, could she die? And the doctor said she could. It was so scary.
When I started clawing at my neck and trying to breathe, and I thought, you know, what are we going to do if I die here? How's everyone going to go on?
When someone's gravely sick or injured in the bush, they rely on the Royal Flying Doctor Service. But now the Flying Doctor needs your help to fund vital medical equipment and supplies. Please search Flying Doctor online to give a regular gift of just $10. You can help equip the Flying Doctor's teams to respond to any emergency anywhere. Search Flying Doctor online. Become a part of the Royal Flying Doctor Service and help save lives in the bush.
Che color? Perfecto, mijo.
Gracias, thank you.
What's wrong, mijo?
Donating to a pet's medical care is one of the many ways you can help families in your community. Pets and people belong together. Learn more at petsandpeopletogether.org.
Rick Mon is locked and loaded on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Okay, Hadley, we were talking just before the break there. You were mentioning manufacturing. And again, one of the red flags that was brought up whenever these jabs were rolled out to people was, well, how did they develop this, run it through trials, deem it to be safe in the space of, I think it was about 9 or 10 months. I think from the vaccines were first announced, which was about March of 2020. I think the first jabs were given to people in the UK in December of 2020. So let's say 9 months. 9 months from the announcement of their existence to the scaling up or the manufacturing of billions and billions of doses, effectively passing any clinical trials, which again, if you brought that up and you said, well, where's the clinical trials? Oh, they're safe, they've been tested. I can remember, and you can correct me if I'm wrong in this one, that Pfizer admitted that the people getting the injections were effectively part of the clinical trial until around about January of 2023 or February of 2023. The people rolling up their sleeves or taking the jab, taking it for the family and friends, doing what was right for the community, they were effectively the clinical trial, and just being, the data was being harvested from the people that were just running to the vaccination centers.
Yeah, well, that would have been fine if the products they were making in the supply chain had been safe and effective. But you know a clinical trial, the data is tested to a certain extent. But that's why you have to go through all the checks and balances to make sure that the supply chain is fully joined up and producing what you want to produce. And what I find is that people don't really understand these steps that go into it. But if I can just explain the steps very quickly.
Yeah,
I mean, if you take AstraZeneca and the that jab, it was chimpanzee cells. They then ship them to another company who produces the drug substance. Then they ship that to another company who produces the drug product. This is the vials, and then they ship it into the vaccination centers. So these are traveling thousands of miles, going through different companies who don't talk to the other companies. And the other key point, again, if we take AstraZeneca, they did not develop or manufacture the injections. It was a company in Oxford called Oxford Biomedica. I know that because I consulted to them in 2013 on a UK government advanced manufacturing supply chain grant. And I got them through to £7.1 million worth of funding for a gene therapy product which launched in 2017. It's called Kymriah, and it's marketed by Novartis. And at launch, it cost $475,000 for one treatment. Now, this supply chain is the world's most complex because it's a treatment for a single patient, and the hospital has to take cells out of the patient, go through what they call apheresis, which is to extract the T cells, send those 300, 400, 500 miles down the road by air to the manufacturing plant. They take 2 to 6 weeks to do the genetic conversion, and they have to send it back then to the hospital. And the patient has to get exactly the same cells, otherwise they're dead. So the chain of identity is absolutely crucial. So, and this is the gene therapy that is on the market and approved. And there are known side effects of neurological toxicities and cytokine release syndrome documented on the FDA website. So Sarah Gilbert had nothing to do with this when she was applauded at Wimbledon for all this work she did in developing the AstraZeneca drug. She did it. Same as AstraZeneca. AstraZeneca really don't own any of the facilities, and they would have just been pulling the strings as best they could. So when you know that, you think, not only was this at a ridiculously fast speed, but no one was in charge. No one selling the product. You know, if you bought a plane, you'd expect the plane company to be sure that it was made to the right standards, so you wouldn't get sued under product liability legislation. Mm-hmm. And that's still, I still think that's an option.
Here's the thing. I can remember the first product on the market in the UK was, it was marketed as the Oxford AstraZeneca product. They tried to make it sound as British as possible. Matt Hancock was trying to claim as much credit for this as possible, getting it into people's arms as quickly as possible. I can remember, Hedley, in 2021, just about 3 to 4 months after this was rolled out, I started to make commentary videos on social media platforms, and it was about AstraZeneca injections. And one of the things that I noticed back then was a lot of European countries suspended the use of AstraZeneca very quickly because of clotting concerns. The only place that never suspended the use of the AstraZeneca product was the United Kingdom. Okay, then the directives came out to say, well, this may not be suitable for people under 30 years of age. This may not be suitable for people under 40 years of age. You'd be better getting the Johnson & Johnson shot. You'd be better getting the Pfizer shot, which I believe were mRNA shots. Now, the AstraZeneca product seems to have disappeared completely. It's never mentioned anymore. It's almost like they're hoping people forget about it. Just how experimental was that shot? And why was Britain the only company not to put a pause on its rollout when at one point 15 other countries were certainly questioning whether or not they were causing blood clots in its recipients?
Yeah, well, personally, the research I've done over the last 4 years is that the UK government is fully behind the whole thing. They want to be number one in the world in life sciences. Mm-hmm. And whether they know or not how experimental and how dangerous these are, when I was at Oxford Biomedica in 2013, we had a visit from the Office of Life Sciences. Boris Johnson has been there. And they fell in love with these gene therapies. And I knew at the time, they were very early stage. The regulatory terrain is still evolving. And at the time, they were using these things called cell factories to grow the cells. And the investment they had was to move into bioreactors. But still very early stage in the development of a production and manufacturing supply chain. So I was absolutely gobsmacked when I realized that these were being approved. You know, obviously it was completely wrong. But what I'm saying is that we've got the cell and gene therapy catapult that was set up in the UK by UK government, a part of UKTI or one of the investment things. But they've been set up to promote gene therapy. They're based in Stevenage. And they've built a £66 million plant to make gene therapies in Stevenage Town Centre. Honestly, mm-hmm. you wouldn't believe it. There's a lady, Cheryl Granger, who I know. She lives in Stevenage, and she keeps telling me about this. And she writes to the local council, do you know that you're going to have these dangerous materials in Stevenage Town Centre? And they've just said, well, the MHRA said it's okay, so it's okay. I mean, you know, it's so concerning, you can't even explain.
I think, Hedley, as well, one of the biggest tragedies of all this is we're still yet to see the full fallout and the full damage that's being done from this humongous rollout, not just in the UK and Ireland, but of course, right across Europe, right across the world. We're maybe even only seeing the tip of the iceberg when it comes to injuries and deaths, because of course, the yellow card scheme and the feedback schemes, the VAERS schemes are traditionally underreported. You know, a lot of people don't report side effects or deaths because there's simply been said, well, it maybe was just a coincidence. So I think we're still to see the full fallout for this. And we don't have much time left, actually. So in case I forget to do this, I want to direct people towards your Substack page. You have a Substack page, and I believe that's the way forward for getting information out there too. There's so much censorship on social media platforms at the minute. If you do use Substack, please go on and search out Hedley Rees, HEDLEY REES on the Substack platform, and subscribe to him there or follow him there to get updates on the research that he's publishing. And of course, the book that's available, that book, by the way, was written in 2019. So it was a little bit ahead of its time, given that what has happened since then. You can go on and you can check out that book, Taming the Big Pharma Monster. So I think that's available. If people go onto Amazon, they'll be able to pick that up. Hedley, is that correct? Just as we wrap this up.
Yeah, on Amazon, and Inside Pharma is the name of the Substack, and there's 3 years of evidence there for people to pick up. So sorry to plug there, but
no, it's fine. Please do. So it's Inside Pharma. It's just when I went onto your Substack page, the little substack.com/said, just said at Hedley Rees, but it's called Inside Pharma or Headley Reese. If you search for that on Substack, no doubt you'll find it. And obviously, check out that book, Taming the Big Pharma Monster. And one of the questions was, you know, why do you call it a monster? That was a question that was asked to you back in 2019. I would say it's no longer a monster. I'd say it's a rampant, unchecked serial killer right now. And its job has not yet finished. So, Headley, massive thanks to you this morning for coming on and speaking so frankly, so openly, and obviously so knowledgeably about this industry in particular. And I'm sad to say, but I think we're going to talk again, because this business isn't going away anywhere. It'd be nice of you to just drift off into retirement and me to be talking about the birds and the bees and nice happy things, but unfortunately that's not the way of the world right now. So Headley, I've got to go now. Massive thanks to you again. Thank you so much for coming on today. I'm Rick Munn. I'll be back on in the morning with more on Locked and Loaded. James Freeman's incoming here. Don't go away. Stay tuned for more on TNT.